Hi friends! A short message before we start the episode. Every time we meet a new scientist, we love to chat with him or her over a good coffee or tea. So if you like the show and want to support our work, here are two ways to do it. The first one is to go on our page, Buy Me a Coffee, by following the link in the show notes, and to offer us a coffee. Simple, effective, and we won't forget to thank you. The second way is just as simple. Just share your opinion about the episode on Twitter by tagging us at LonelyPipette. We won't miss to answer you. Thanks again for the sharing and à bientôt.
She told me, you need to understand what you're good at. You need to understand what you suck at and be very, very upfront with yourself. Because if you corner yourself, pushing yourself to do the things that you are bad at, you're going to set yourself for failure.
Are you working in research, trying to do the best science you can?
Are you a team leader, a research assistant, postdoc, PhD student, or any other type of scientist?
Are you looking for a place where you can sit, relax, and listen to inspiring people?
Well, we have good news for you. You've just found what you're looking for.
Hi everybody, my name is Renaud Pourpre.
And I am Jonathan Weitzman.
Welcome to the Lonely Pipette,
helping scientists
do better science.
My name is Elfin Genora. I work on developmental gene regulation at the University of California, San Francisco. And I'm very happy and also a little nervous to share my tips with the Lonely Pipette.
Thanks. So Elfin Genora grew up in France. He did his PhD in Edith Hurd's lab at the Curie Institute in Paris, working on X inactivation. He then moved to San Francisco for a postdoc with Benoit Bruneau at the Gladstone Institute, where he continued his interest in chromosome organization and gene regulation. In 2019, he established his own research group in the Cardiovascular Research Institute at UCSF, and his team studies genome organization and how this impacts gene regulation in developmental and disease contexts. Elfej, thanks for coming to share your tips with the Lonely Pipette.
Okay, thank you, Elfej, to be with us today. I have something to add on the top of the introduction of Jonathan. Last year, we had Maxime Greenberg as a first guest for the Lonely Pipette. And actually, he's an American that went here in France to start his own lab. And now today, we are going to talk about you. And it's a bit a mirror because you are a French guy that moved there in USA to start your own lab. But we are going...
You probably crossed paths with Max as well.
Yes, we did. I was finishing at the Curie and then he was starting his illustrious career there.
So what this is one thing we're hoping is that the different guests of the Lonely Pipette will begin to see the links between them. And I believe your old mentor, she's going to be one of our guests as well. So
looking forward to hear about her.
So it'd be great to hear from both sides. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So much pressure. We are going to start with the first and probably famous question, which is your origin story, like Batman or Superman, but your science man, or let's say, we'll see. So tell us a bit, how did you decide to become a scientist? What's behind that?
I think it started actually quite early in my childhood. I remember my mother telling me that when I was 5 or 6 years old, I would look at the illustrations in medical books, and I would be very interested about the human body, what's inside, what's behind your skin. And I also have these memories that really haunt me about this. I think it was a Belgian cartoon. In French, it's called Il était une fois la vie, Once Upon a Time.
Ah.
And I remember watching, it's about... And it's an animated series. I think it's about 24 episodes or something. And little red blood cells have a life and things to say. And they meet the the white blood cells and our chromosomes involved and all of that. And it's, I think it kind of haunted me. I was talking about lymphocytes and platelets and things like that when I was very, very young. So I think I always was, again, attracted by the microscopic, the things that are around us, in us, that make us, but you can't really see or have direct access to with your senses. And then I think when I was a teenager, I had more of like a philosophical interrogations about what is life, what is meant to be, where are we going, sort of more personal sort of interrogations, I would say. And I found a lot of answers actually going in biology on a philosophical side. And I think a lot of the questions that I had were answered by the very fact that they were wrong. They were wrongly framed, I would say. And I remember very distinctly the first year of university, we were taught a lot about phylogeny and the relationship between different organisms. And that for me was very an eye-opener, like the answer that I was looking for were not in where are we going, but much more where are we coming from. What is the history of species? And learning about the relationship and the evolutionary trajectory of the species made me realize that the best way to explain who we are right now is to understand sort of the history and the evolutionary past of that led us to be human. And it was also quite freeing because it made me realize that nothing is necessarily written for a specific goal, and it is actually empowering that as humans we have this ability to do a little bit more than just what our biology is. And I found it very pacifying to be able to think about those things in a different angle. My family is a direct family, does not have any biologists or any scientists, so I guess for me I came a little late to that realization, because I had philosophers, I had people thinking about French literature, history and whatnot, and human sciences around me, but no one really in science.
Did your parent offer you a microscope when you were young?
Actually, they did. I remember hating it because it would take me so long to just find a focal plane. And then, of course, it was not a fancy thing. So I also didn't like that if you zoom very hard on something and you have no expectation, you actually don't understand what you're looking at.
So you don't find the answers.
You don't find any answers. And again, so I did have a microscope, but it wasn't the best memory.
So jumping on the answers, because I see that you're driven by your curiosity and everything. So you're looking for answers and you went into research for this. But sometimes we don't find the answers. So did you had one time a lot of doubts where you even consider living science?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always kind of there, not living science, but there's, I think we all have this imposter syndrome or there a bit of an inner saboteur where we are thinking we're not meant to be necessarily. And I think science, when the first time you walk into a lab, to be honest, I don't know if you remember, but everything is new. Yeah, there are all of these codes of conduct that are not told where this needs to go here and you need to replace things exactly where you initially put them. And there are all these rules that dictate how you should behave in a lab that you don't understand when you first start. And I do remember, and actually the first time I walked in the lab was Jonathan was the neighbor. And I knew nothing. I was, I think it was my first year of university. I spent 2 weeks in the unit of Moshe Yaniv. It was my very first exposure to molecular biology in the lab. And I remember, yes, being very intrigued by the social aspect of it, where, yes, people behave in a very, very specific way, not just with equipment, but even related to each other. There are notes to tell you how to use things and how to leave things. And it is not intuitive at all. And I think this, even when you get used to behaving in the lab and you get more comfortable, there is always at each stage this, for example, now that I'm a faculty, I see the faculty in faculty meeting, people behaving in ways that seem very strange, I would say, to me, and it makes sense to them. And at each step, there's an adaptation stage. And I think you never feel completely that you belong. It's always a learning curve, kind of. And therefore, it's not that pushes you necessarily to feel you should quit, but there's always the questioning of whether you are at the right place. And what is nice, the older I would say you get to make your own place, but each new step is always a moment of I would say doubt and challenges.
So we want to talk through some of your steps, and you're right. I'd forgotten that actually I met you when you were an undergraduate.
And, yeah, I was 17, I think. Yeah,
Moshe had come around the lab saying, you know, I agreed to take this kid for 2 weeks and will someone look after him? And then we crossed again because you came and joined the Magister. And then we crossed again when you went to do your PhD with Edith Hurd. So can you tell us something about, so Edith is a very famous scientist. She was running a very successful lab at the Curie Institute. We're going to be hearing from Edith at some point in the Lonely Pipette. But it'd be nice to hear it from your side. What do you think is the most important thing that you learned from that time in Edith's lab and from Edith herself?
I learned many things with Edith, and I'm actually discovering now that I learned more than I thought I did at the time.
Nice.
Now that I have to play the PI. And I think one of the things that I really often think about is, at least with me, Edith had this way of making me feel we were on the same boat. She was very demanding, and you know, the standards were very, very high. But she had this way of understanding what drives each person and sort of tap into that drive, which was different between me and other colleagues and between them as well. But always making people feel, again, that they belong, that they want to work here, that the goals are aligned. Never I thought she was a slave driver. Never I thought she was asking me to do something I didn't want to do. And I remember very distinctly a couple of times I was working on a very difficult project initially. And I remember one day writing down all the reasons why that project was not going to work, why we need to quit, why I didn't feel happy about that project. And I came with my post-it in the office, and I went through the reasons. And all I remember is an hour later, I leave the office and I'm like, my project is great. I love my project, and I need to work so hard because I'm so lucky to be working on that project.
You remind me of a conversation I had with Alicia Cockwader, who did her PhD with me, and she came in the second year with the same thing, saying, I want to stop the project. This is not what I came for. And she said the hypothesis is wrong. So I said, fine, show me the experiment that shows that the hypothesis was wrong. And she didn't have the data, so she said, I'm going to do the experiment to show that this hypothesis is wrong. And she did the best experiment. It turned out the hypothesis was right, and it's one of the figures in the paper. But it's the best experiment she did, and she did it to show me that I was wrong.
Yeah, in my case, we ended up dumping that project, actually. But it was never out of anger or out of disappointment. It was always so constructive. And so now when I talk to people in my lab, I really try to get to remember how did Edith, and how did she manage to understand what was driving me? How did she understand how to be both respectful, but also, you know, directive? And how did she work that fine line between guidance and doing things for me? Like I never felt she was driving things against my will, and it was such an interesting leadership style.
It's very interesting what you said, that you often realize afterwards when you try to do it yourself how clever the leadership skills were.
Edith, if you're listening to this, we were actually joking about it or talking about it, and sometimes we would one or two days after our meetings with Edith, we would have coffee with the other lab members, and suddenly we're like, she got me again. Like she managed to convince me to like re-up my enthusiasm about things, and she got me again. But never in a bad way. We were just joking because we were all amazed kind of how skillful and natural that was. It never felt manipulative. It just felt, very, very connected.
So I also, when I was in Moshe Yaniv's lab, I kept saying, you know, he's been so successful. What can I learn from him? And I kept saying to teach me, you know, teach me. And he sort of refused to teach me. He just, it was years later when I ran my own lab that I realized how much I'd learned from him.
Yeah, yeah. This is exactly how I feel now.
So then you got up and packed your bags and went off to San Francisco for a postdoc. How did that happen? Why San Francisco?
That's another funny story, I think. retrospectively, it's funny. It was very difficult to leave Edith's lab for several reasons. I was very happy there. I was very happy in Paris, which is where all my family is. I was very happy with my project that after 4 years of not sure whether it would work, finally worked. And I felt all we had to do was just to reap the fruits of all of that, everything we had invested. It was also another thing scientifically that had just happened. So to give a little bit of context, we were looking at chromosome organization using high-throughput chromosome conformation capture, which are these technologies that allowed us to look at things at much higher resolution than we used to by imaging. And it was at a time where we also, other people were developing genomic assays such as ChIP-seq and accessibility, and basically identifying all of these constellation of potential gene regulatory elements that we were very interested about. And my work then started to connect those regulatory elements between each other by looking at the three-dimensional organization. And so my PhD was just the mapping of these interactions. But then something had happened, which was the second wave of genome editing revolution with TALENs. Not CRISPR, it was before CRISPR, but with TALENs. And we were able to design nucleases. It was very much more difficult than what you would do with CRISPR, but the idea is the same. We could go in and delete, invert, replace, change, remobilize any elements that we wanted. And we had the map. We just had charted the map. So I stayed after graduating with Edith for almost a year, I think, with a paper published. No need to acquire more data, I would say, to graduate. But just because I was a leech, basically, I was designing all of these talents and doing all of this deletion. And I was like, please, 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 I want to know the phenotype. We looked at these things for so long and now we can test whether they're functional or not. So that kind of diverted me from thinking harder about my postdoc, I think. And it took me a really long time to find out what I wanted to do. And I did lots of interviews. It took me a very long time to get back at all of these PIs that gave me the opportunity to interview with them. And so I apologize to everyone because I think I was too obsessed still with X chromosome inactivation and what we had done. So in the end, I decided to try to do something very different, both personally by moving basically the furthest I could from Paris, but also
from the chromosome X.
Also, finally moving out of the X chromosome, yes. And initially, I really wanted a developmental component, something that would allow me to study how chromatin-based regulation is important for development in an organism, not just in a model system. And so I moved to San Francisco in Benoit's lab, who really had at that time was really starting to do both the so Benoit is an embryologist initially working on heart development, and he had just started to incorporate some genomic aspects and epigenetic aspects in that, and he had just developed an in vitro system using embryonic stem cells to sort of mirror or complement the in vivo embryology. So my expertise was in ESLs, and I thought that initially it would be great to learn the embryology so I could do both the in vitro and the in vivo work and whatnot. And Benoit was also, although he had a very classic embryology background, he was really incredibly fast at picking up all of these genomic techniques and all of these new high-throughput methods and incorporating that into his research program in a very natural way. Very, very impressive. And so I felt it was going to be a great way to be surrounded by people who think about embryology. And so Benoit, again, had this very impressive ability to understand many different fields that revolve around his main questions about how the heart is made and what are the gene regulatory networks that build the heart, to tap in both the classic embryology and the new emerging genomic-based technologies. And although initially I joined because I thought I would get away from the in vitro system, it turned out that Benoit had just developed a new in vitro system to mimic some aspects of the in vivo biology. And on top of it, the talent became completely obsolete because now you could CRISPR out everything that you wanted. And so I think I let that distract me a little bit from the initial goal of learning embryology and development. To just compulsively knock out and knock things in the genome as fast and as I could, to follow up on some questions that I had that were unanswered from my PhD, which were, we can map all of these things, we can map these connections between genes and what might regulate them, but what does it really do? How does that actually work? And what I thought was just a side project initially ended up to really consume all of my time, energy, and thoughts. Not in a bad way, but in an unplanned way, let's say. And the next thing I know, it's been 5 years, and I've been actually not learning any embryology whatsoever. Can barely tell the difference between the gut and the heart on a.
So you moved to learn embryology, and you didn't at the end.
I did not in the end at all.
Is it that bad at the end?
Well, it depends what you want. If I really wanted to become an embryologist, then it would be failed. But I think if I really wanted to become an embryologist, I would have, you know, let the ESLs alone and try harder. And I often think, how did that happen? So Benoit was very, very hands-off and very, very trusty. And he is very trusty. And so I think he just let me pursue my passion without necessarily telling me this is not what I came here to do. And he was just very supportive, very different leadership style than Edith, but very effective as well. And the next thing I know again is, I'm there applying for positions and I don't know anything about the heart. I don't know anything about the embryology. I have this stamp from my PhD being a chromosome biologist that I just cemented with my postdoc instead of doing something completely different. And initially, I thought it was going to be bad because people had told me you can't just do a postdoc to work on the same thing as your PhD. A, it's not the goal. You need to expand. It's the opportunity for you to learn new things. And B, it's going to look bad when you apply for a PhD, for a position. People are going to question whether you know how to do anything else or whether you just pigeonhole yourself. And I was very self-conscious about that. And to my surprise, people loved it. People loved that I had, you know, made a map in my PhD and then made ways to address how the map is actually comes to be during my postdoc. And it was not a problem at all, even though I felt very self-conscious about it. So I don't know if it's a piece of advice or not, but that's what happened to me.
So how did you decide that you were ready to set up your own team?
Again, I think you're never ready. Transitions have always been very hard for me. PhD to postdoc, Edith had literally to kick me out of the lab, stop paying me, take my badge, and even though I would find ways to come in the lab and finish some experiments. So it was rough. And I think a little kind of the same thing happened with Benoit. I was also very happy at the Gladstone with Benoit. Pretty productive as well. And the environment there is very comfortable and really amazing. And so I guess I didn't really want to leave, but at some point you have to. I didn't feel ready to start my group, but the year your big paper comes out is sort of the year where people are going to pay the most attention to you. And so you have to go on a tour where you apply to several institutions and you visit them once, you visit them twice. You come back home and you're terrified about making a wrong choice, even though that is clearly not the right way to think about it. I don't think there was any wrong choice. All of the opportunities were very different, but I don't think there was any wrong choice. But choosing was very, very daunting. And in the end, I decided to come to the University of California, which is literally two blocks away from the Gladstone Institute where Benoit's lab is. For several reasons, some of them I think personal. I wanted to stay in the Bay Area if possible. But another reason was I felt it was the most different, the department where people were doing the most different things than my expertise, and I really wanted that again to be able to, now that I accept that I'm going to be a chromosome biologist and I'm not going to pretend to be an embryologist. I felt I needed to be surrounded by people with very different expertise. So on the medium and long term, there would be the most unusual and unexpected synergies, let's say.
Complementary at the end.
Exactly.
You were also looking for that. So here you are, you were a postdoc. At which stage of your postdoc did you decide, okay, now I'm going to apply there or I'm going to visit there?
I think it was all planned. So one thing I have to say about the Gladstone Institute is the day or the week I joined, we started to chart a plan. Like they sat me down and they told me, okay, you come in for a postdoc. What is the goal of the postdoc? It's twofold. One is you have to do great science. But the other one is you have to develop your career. And you have to do both. So I think from day one, we had a plan and we strategized and we talked very openly about what do you need to apply, what do you need to prepare for applying. A paper is not sufficient. You need to actually have a research program as well. So you need to think about all of those things. And they really, really prepared me in thinking about all of these softer skills, I would say, that you have to develop in order to feel ready to apply. And then when the paper came out, it became pretty natural that was the time. Okay. So we put our paper on a bioarchive, I think, in December. And then I had the paper out in, I think, June that year. And that was basically I went to several meetings to showcase the work. And what was also very important is that Benoit encouraged me to present the work myself. So I could actually showcase the work without him necessarily being stamped as it's coming from his lab. And that was instrumental, really, to get my name out there. And then in October of that year, it was very clear that it was now or never. The paper was getting traction and recognition. And so it was let's go. And in the US, the application cycle is rather synchronized between institutions. So although you have to apply separately for each institution, each university has their own recruitment pipeline, they all start roughly at the same time. And so you can synchronize and sort of apply with similar documentation. But then it's almost a full-time job. Sorry.
No. So yeah, I was just, I wanted to jump on something you said. You talked about soft skills. So did you ever consider taking a management course or learn new soft skills before or during this transition?
Absolutely. And so this is something that is strongly encouraged at the Gladstone Institute. They have this postdoc development pipeline, I would say. And they offer a lot of opportunities for people who feel they would benefit from leadership and management courses, classes, or even just talking about it. And I felt that was very, very helpful. And I'm going to give one example of a surprising thing that I've learned during those classes.
Let's go.
one thing they made us do is take a personality test to understand, you know, how introverted you are, how much of a thinker, how impulsive you are and whatnot. And I remember being very triggered by this, thinking, why would they want to put me in a box? I don't belong in a box and I'm more complicated than that. And then the teacher talked to me, no. It's not about you. You have to understand what is your impulse, what is your initial way of reacting so you can adjust accordingly to other people who might be different. And so it taking your own something that tells you about your own personality is not about, it's not sort of a egotistic or self-flattering thing or to understand more about you. It's to understand about how to interact with other people. And then I started to actually use that analytic grid to understand a little bit better the personality of the people around me, both on the PIs or the students or whatnot. And indeed, realized all of a sudden it was an eye-opener to me that a lot, I could see how a lot of people actually realized that a lot of people in their professional setting really act against their initial impulse. For example, lots of introverted people will come across as very extroverted, not because they are, but because that's their way of compensating, let's say. And however, it is important to acknowledge that these people tend to be initially introverted, because if you treat them as purely extroverted, you're missing out a lot. And there were a couple of people higher up in a hierarchy, for example, that I realized were not as extroverted as they wanted me to think. And so the next time I met with them, I treated them as introverted by making sure I was not talking over them and making sure I was giving them time to actually talk without trying to avoid any awkward silence. And I got so much more feedback because now they had the time to tap in sort of their deep thinking and give me the feedback that I needed. And so that was very helpful.
So this theoretical consideration and training actually turns out to be applicable in the lab. But what has been the most difficult thing about setting up the lab?
There are several things that are still very difficult and challenging. I would say the first one is recruiting. When you're a postdoc, you're coming from a pedigree with very famous and very visible people. Great. You think you are the thing. You think everyone is going to beg, write to you the minute you have an ad to work with you. No, that was absolutely not the case. I was still lucky enough to have some visibility because the PIs I worked with were very visible and I clearly benefited from that. But recruiting, attracting people was more difficult than what I thought. I got very lucky, and in the end, I attracted people who are very, very dedicated and talented. But it was very difficult to understand how to do that.
So what have you learned, Elfej? What was the trick to getting the right recruiting?
I think one thing that really, really helped was present your work early, if you can. During my postdoc, I had a very important result that is at the core of what we ended up writing in the paper. And I presented this 2 or maybe 2.5 years before the final paper, before we wrapped up the final paper. So everyone in the field knew about that core finding for a very long time. And everyone knew we did it. And
you were not worried about being scooped? Or?
I was, and that kind of happened. So again, you have to do it in a way that you feel makes sense. We had some technical issues that we thought we were going to be much faster at wrapping up. And we had technical issues that are not very interesting for today that delayed us. But in the end, it still, I think, served me a lot to be associated with that result that became kind of core in the field. And people knew again that it was our doing. I think it would not have worked as well if we had played, you know, ninja mode and just don't say anything until your paper is published. That doesn't help too much. So you have to find a way. Sorry.
No. So you're saying that you have to expose yourself, you think?
Yes,
in some way.
Yeah, it's quite important. If you don't necessarily want or cannot do a presentation, at least posters and being very present in meetings, I think is very helpful. You get to meet people and people get to meet you. This is how one of the postdoc in my lab actually met me. It was at the conference. So I think it's very important for your visibility to share early if you can.
So once the CVs came flooding in, how do you choose? What are you looking for?
Oh, Jonathan, the problem was not choosing from which CV. The problem was getting CVs. And well, you know, also you have limited resources initially. So typically the first person you hire is the person you can hire before you can secure external funding. So I got very lucky. I don't have a magic recipe, except that I wouldn't have found talented people as early had they not known me through conferences.
How did you choose? So you said you went to Edith's lab, you did this chromosome organization, went to Benoit's lab, tried to get away from it, but was stuck in this or obsessed with the chromosome organization. How did you decide what your lab was going to be?
I'm still trying to figure it out. In a sense that I think my interests in biology are broader than my reputation, I would say. In a sense that in Edith's lab, I learned a lot about chromatin states, developmental memory of transcription states, how do cells remember which gene to turn on and off and whatnot, which is not necessarily directly related to the chromosome organization work that we ended up publishing. And so now when I write a grant, for example, that is not on chromosome organization, but on these other topics, it's harder for me to convince people that I have expertise in that. So initially, my decision has been to make sure we can secure funding as early as external funding as early as possible, and therefore leverage that credibility that I have in chromosome organization. So we really followed up on the molecular mechanisms of chromosome organization, and we'll see whether science takes us. And we'll see also who else knock on our door. I had people coming in that had expertise in chromosome organization. So that is also what we ended up really investing in. But if the next person has more background in something completely different, I'm still very keen to entertain that.
So tell us just one more thing about that point. So often people think that the head of the lab defines the direction of the lab. And now you're sort of suggesting, which is, I think, what I've found as well, that the direction of the lab depends a little bit on who joins the lab and what their interests are. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that is also something that I experienced as a trainee in two almost polar opposites, one with Edith and one with Benoit. Edith had very clear ideas on what she wanted to be recognized for, I think. So it was X chromosome inactivation, and we had these very clear questions, how does that work? Benoit had a very, very different opinion, I think, or way of thinking, where it was much more, Benoit's style was much more, come, we'll find something fun and great for you to do that you enjoy. And this is, I guess, why I ended up not doing embryology. And when I joined, I thought it was going to be like in Edith's lab, where there was going to be directions in terms of what I should be thinking about or what I'm allowed to work on. And initially in Benoit's lab, I have to say, it was a little daunting because everything was on the table. You want to do that? You don't know how to do it? Well, find someone who can teach you. And so you had to decide yourself really what you wanted to do. And it is both freeing and again, a little daunting. So now I'm trying to think, what do I want to do for my lab? And which of these traits I want to adopt more? And I think it has to be a balance, and also it has to be defined depending on each person. Some people some people's creativity really only shines when you leave them alone. And other people's productivity only shines when you help them define very clear tasks. And I'm always still struggling. And I discuss that with my group very often, actually. I'm asking them, do you have enough directions or am I being suffocating? And I frame it exactly just like that because I need to understand what do they want. I realize maybe it's not fair completely for me to ask them because they might not know what they want or what they need at this early stage. But it is something that is different, for, I think, for every trainee and might be different also for different stages in the lab. We have to be more focused right now. So I have ideas on, again, what I would like us to contribute to in the next year or so. But we'll see as we grow.
Great. So we're going to take a break. We've heard a lot about your lab and your career. After the break, we'll hear more about Elfej himself.
Hey, folks, don't run away. You're listening to The Lonely Pipette with Renaud Pourpre and Jonathan Weissman, where our goal is to help scientists do better science.
If you're enjoying the show and you want to learn more, you can follow us on Twitter at Lonely Pipette. And please share the podcast with your friends.
If you don't want to miss any of our future episodes, you can subscribe to our mailing list and join our community. Click on the subscription link on our Twitter account.
It's as simple as that. Take a few moments to get more tips from the Lonely Pipette.
So welcome back, Elfej, Jonathan, for the part two of this episode of The Lonely Pipette. Thank you, Elfej. You've been amazing since the beginning, and it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
I think the listeners will like it too. And now we want to jump more into what we call lifestyle values. So there is something that we asked the first season, and we are going again to ask it. But do you know famous entrepreneur like to share their morning routine? You know, this is kind of a personal habit they have to get ready. So the question is, do you have one to get ready?
There is some reproducibility in a sense that usually I wake up late. I feel late, I run to the lab and feel behind everything. That is, I think, the routine.
That happened to me too.
I wish I had something a little bit more of a routine sometimes, but I've always been rather impulsive in a sense that if I'm in the lab finishing up an experiment and I really want to know, I'm going to stay until I know. And it might be 10 p.m., it might be 2 a.m., it might be 4 a.m.
Are you still at the bench, Elfej?
Yes, I've been doing some experiments, yes. Helping, doing the difficult sort of high-risk ones where I didn't want people to necessarily risk wasting their time on. And as soon as I know that it's actually worth pursuing, then I hand it over. But we're only five people right now, and so it's things have to move in. But the current season is approaching, and so I'm not going to be able to do that as much. But I realize I need some bench time to regroup, and it's very helpful for my mental health.
Are you struck by things that are different between France and the States? I noticed on your website that you have a page that helps people pronounce your name. So obviously that's one of the things. Are there other things about living in the States and different languages and cultures?
Every day, Jonathan, every day. At many different levels, both the science, the trainees, the environment, the people, the politics, everything is still very exotic to me. Even though I've been here for 8 years, I think it's part of the fun and part of why I wanted to stay here. Not the politics so much, but the rest. Yeah, I don't know exactly where to begin. I think, so what maybe strikes me the most when I come back to France, I still try to go back at least two or three times a year, is this sentiment of freedom, really. I mean, it's going to sound very cheesy and stupid, but you come here and you do you. People are not necessarily going to judge the same way or be as inquisitive. And it's true both on the personal lifestyle side. It's also true on the science side. What I felt quite liberating coming here. And actually, it's something that Edith had told me, my PhD advisor had told me to go to the US to experience exactly that. And if you talk to French scientists and try to convince them of an experiment, the first thing they're going to try to say is, no, doesn't work. No, it's too difficult. No, it's stupid. No. And you have to talk them into doing the experiment, even though in the end, you might actually end up convincing them. In the US, it's a completely the opposite. It is, you think about something half-baked and everyone is, I'm on it, I'm already doing it. And so, of course, you know, in medio stat virtus, you want to be in the middle. You want to think enough so you do the smart things. But there is this feeling of, yes, we can. And again, it is very cheesy, but it is true. And so I feel privileged and lucky to have both experience, the sort of more conservative side and as well as the more unleashed side. And I try to apply that to both personal lifestyle and science style as well.
So you said that, you know, there's some stereotypes between American and French. What is something about yourself that people would be surprised to discover, even knowing that you're French?
Something not a lot of people know. I have a famous dad who is not a scientist, who works in human sciences. He is not Twitter famous, but he is very famous in his contribution to a field of basically trying to understand the difference between history and memory. And at what point human communities decide that something is history versus something that is more personal than they remember, amongst other things. And he is very, 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 very active. He just wrote a book this year during the pandemic, even though he's turning 90 this year. So that is quite inspiring to have someone to talk to on something completely different than the science. And so sometimes, oftentimes, when I have to talk to him about what I do, I have to conceptualize 3-4 level out. He doesn't really care about the strategy that I use for answering a specific question. He really needs the very high level answer, but then is still able to give me some feedback on those conceptual ways to consider or consider your experimental strategies, even though he's not a scientist.
So does he have to deal with people? That's really interesting. Does he have interesting inputs or thoughts about how the scientific community deals with this balance between history and memory?
Himself, not directly, but he had people around him thinking about a lot about those things. And so I've had the privilege to have access to that sphere as well. Funny story and also something maybe surprising. So even though I said I didn't have any scientists in my direct family, it's not completely true. Because my cousin's father was the spouse of François Jacob, one of the French Nobelists for many things, including gene regulation. And so there was a lot of work from François Jacob, who was very inspiring to me as a student when I was reading his books, not his papers, but the books, the Logique du Vivant and whatnot, about indeed this ability to understand the social or the impact on society or our understanding of reality and humankind that molecular biologists have brought on the table. And I think to me that really resonated with that need for abstraction and philosophy a little bit. Even though I was going for a scientific career, to me it's still very sort of intertwined with what we do as scientists. Sometimes we lose track of it, but this abstraction and this impact on society is also something that is very very much of a goal.
So you've moved around quite a bit and seen different things. We wondered, in the last 5 years, do you have a belief or a new behavior or a new habit that's improved your life? Can you think of something?
Yes, I think I will also say something maybe a little bit controversial.
Let's go!
When I moved to the US, I've learned with shock that being a perfectionist was a bad thing. And all my life, I grew up with people who had the highest standards on around scientifically and whatnot. And, you know, whenever I had to write a document, it had to be perfect. So you work on it as long as you can and use all of your emotional resources channeled into doing that thing absolutely perfect. And then when I moved to the US, I realized that the ambition was not compatible with making everything perfect. Sometimes if you want to do something absolutely perfect, it just doesn't happen because you don't have the bandwidth to do everything. And it's oftentimes better to do something imperfectly than not doing it at all. And we had conversations with Benoit like that, where he oftentimes asked me, well, some things need to be perfect, but some things don't need to be perfect. And you are the only judge of that. But you have to ask yourself, is it worth channeling all that energy into this? Because everything that you do is a choice. If you choose to spend time on one thing, you are indirectly choosing not to spend time on other things. And it is true in your work, and it's true in your personal life, and it's true at the connection between your work and your personal life as well. So I'm still struggling every day with this feeling, I have to say. For example, again, when you write a grant, it has to be really, really good. It has to be near perfect. But if you work on it so hard that it's absolutely perfect, does it give you really this boost in chances to get funded? And if not, is that time not best spent in writing another grant? Again, I'm struggling because I don't want to have lower standards, and no one wants to. But you also have to be okay with not having everything perfect, and sometimes having things work is good. Or now, also, what's fun is I have people working with me as a team in a group, and so sometimes if I don't get to do something perfect, maybe they can get it perfect, and learning how to let go is also a new thing. So that definitely changed for me when I moved here.
About perfectionism, have you ever found yourself blocked because of this? Like you couldn't go a step further, so you quit it. Like, I don't know.
Absolutely. I can give you another concrete example on how being a perfectionist can be a disservice. It's something that came up in a conversation last week, actually, with a senior faculty. Sometimes you think that you can't really venture out of your field because you don't have the not only you don't have the credentials, but you don't know everything about that new field. For example, let's say I want to understand how the molecular mechanisms of chromosome folding are important for heart function, the heart development, and whatnot. I feel very self-inhibited because I feel I don't know enough about heart development, physiology, and whatnot to do something, the perfect contribution. And that can prevent you from venturing in that field in a really, again, self-inhibitory effect. And sometimes you just have to try. Initially, it's not going to be perfect, but surround yourself then with people who can make it better and near perfect, collaborators that have expertise that is complementary to you and whatnot. And I'm trying not to let my lack of expertise in the multidisciplinary approaches inhibit me venturing into those fields. And it is very difficult when you're doing something, because in the end, you know, we don't want to make important contributions. We want to make things that are going to last through the test of time. So we need something perfect or need perfect at the end. But the way to get there is not necessarily to wait to be perfect before you throw yourself out there. And I'm still struggling with that a lot.
Do you have other fears that you could share with us, and how you overcome them?
I think, well, there's, as I said maybe a little bit earlier, there's always this imposter syndrome that I think a lot of us are constantly fighting against, fearing that, yes, we're not good enough, it's not going to work out or whatnot. And the way to deal with that is often to talk about it in a safe environment to people who can offer perspective and also a frank answer. Sometimes you need to hear that what you're doing is not good enough, And it doesn't mean that you are canceled. It just helps you understand, okay, this is something I need to work on. Or you might actually realize that you're good enough on that end, and then you can use your time and resources on something else. And I think dealing with all that just by yourself is not helpful, because then you create these narratives of fears or things that you feel not ready for. And so it's very important to surround yourself with a mentoring group, with people of very different both expertise, age, experience, and you'll get different feedback from these people, and then you get to choose what helps you move forward.
Right. Thank you.
I don't know if that was a good answer or not, but
no, that was good. I just lost track of where we were. it's really interesting, all of this too. Yeah.
Maybe one thing I can add about this support group is, so I started my group in 2019, and then 2020 was 2020. And it's been quite difficult, to be honest, to establish that mentoring support with the senior faculty, for example, in my new department, because there are many people who haven't met physically just yet, because we passed each other maybe a few times before the pandemic, and then ever since they're sheltering or they have a different lifestyle now that allows them to work remotely and whatnot. And so I think to all of the junior faculty who started around that time, we're going to have to be very, very proactive in breaking the ice that settled between our new colleagues and us. And now it does feel a little awkward to email a senior faculty to introduce myself, even though it's been a year and a half. But I think we have to accept that and just do it. Otherwise, we risk this isolation to have longer lasting effects than what we want.
So in practical terms, how do you think departments are going to deal, not just with the post-COVID, but with the general problem that young faculty, there's a lot of pressure, you're surrounded by people who all look brilliant and they all look like they're succeeding and competing. How do we create supportive structures for, particularly for group leaders? So I think for postdocs and students, there are a lot of associations and a lot of talk about pressure. For group leaders, often it's quite lonely.
It is quite lonely, it's true. I don't have a great answer for you, but I would, if anyone has, I would love to hear about it. Little things
keep tuned for the rest of the season.
Maybe the next speaker will have ideas. Little things that can help on both sides, both the faculty side and the junior person as well. So on a junior person, I would say, there's a lot of self-inhibition when you walk into that room and you have at UCSF, for example, in the biochemistry department, there are people that are National Academy of Science. There are people with Nobel Prizes in the room. And so it is extremely daunting to walk in, take a chair and start chit-chatting. And they all know each other from 30 years ago. And so this can be very, very, make you feel not at ease. But I think it's very important for the junior person to feel that they belong and they've been hired in the department. And even if they don't know all the ins and outs just yet, they get to contribute as much as the older one. You don't have any more to prove at that stage. And sometimes we might feel like, okay, I need more contributions, scientific contributions, so people will take me more seriously. And I think if you wait for that, it's going to be a little too late to break the ice. And I see successful, other junior faculties that are much more outgoing, being much more successful in getting support because of their interpersonal skills. So don't be shy.
So just because we don't know when the episode will be released, but maybe you can share the thought with us. How do you plan then to reconnect with the people? What will you suggest to the community now so you can reconnect after this period?
So I'm not doing it very well, but I see some people doing it better than me, and it's inspiring. For example, I have a friend who writes to a senior faculty in either the department or the institution, a different one, at least once a week or twice a week or every 2 weeks. Point blank, just to be on their radar. And sometimes that leads to a quick Zoom chat that she tells me can be very awkward because you've never met the person. There's no agenda except just, I want you to know that I exist. But she told me the return on investment is huge because then these people think about her when they, you know, whenever they think about her. And that is very helpful. The worst that can happen is if you're just not on the map. And thinking you don't deserve just yet to be on their radar because you're no one just yet, I think is not the good way to go about it.
Let's talk about maybe what we call, we love this topic, but I don't like the word of it, failure, because it's just a word, you know. What do you think, did you ever face a failure that you think that helped you to be here now or that has set you for the later success?
Yes, I think I have, and I'm going to expand from failure to frustration. I think the things you get frustrated by in your past influence a lot what you seek out in your future. And for example, when I was a student, I think I was maybe a little frustrated by not having maybe more freedom and whatnot. So I chose a lab for my postdoc that would give me more freedom. And then when I experienced that freedom, I realized that I wanted actually more directions. And so when I start my own group, now I think I'm a bit more hands-on than what I would have thought I would be after my PhD. So it's important to be aware of that, what pushes you to seek out specific things. Those frustrations didn't drive me to the point of failure, but they do orient the way I behave now. And it's good if that can move to your active sphere of sort of self-awareness. So you understand why you're making these decisions, why are you pushing people this direction or another one? And so you can ask yourself, am I doing it because of my past frustrations or am I doing it because of them? Because I think that's what they need. Now, to go back to failure specifically, yes, I had, I think one thing that haunts me is my failure at mathematics when I was in high school. As you might know, there's a big problem in the way mathematics are taught in France. It is setting most of the kids for failure, and to the point that because of the system, you are, if you want to do science, your channel is in one of three directions, basically, after high school. Either you do mathematics, physics, or biology, basically. And the way students are sorted has nothing to do with their interest. The way they're sorted is how good they are at math. The brilliant ones will go to math. The ones that are so-so will go to physics. And the one who suck will go in biology.
That's important, huh?
That's in France. Yeah.
I kind of say that, yeah.
It is really I've seen that, bad. Yeah. And also there's a big gender bias in, I think it has to do again with the way math is actually taught that pushes young women to failure and therefore channel them into the biology branch. In my class of biology, we were 80 to 90% female to male ratio. And if you go to the math room next door, it was 95% males. Is it because women are bad at math? Absolutely not. It has to do with something that is more ingrained in the way math is taught during teenage years, and that skews people. So for some reason, I was really, really bad in high school at math. And that haunts me because I was channeled into biology, although I was very happy to learn about it. I was channeled in a field that was very qualitative, with any hardly quantitative teaching. We had very little math teaching. I took a genetics class, a genetics course, and then we learned basic statistics, but we never learned programming. We never learned differential equations in beyond what is taught in high school and whatnot. And that really haunts me now, where there's really a need for embracing the mathematical models in order to understand the nature of the data we're looking at. And I'm not good at it. I'm not good enough. So luckily I pushed through and now I can hire people who are much better than me and collaborate with people who are much better than me at it. But it's still a sort of something that haunts me.
But I think it's going to change in the way we educate moving. So we're going to start to wrap up with a few quick fire questions. So I see behind you, there's this big whiteboard with lots and lots of words on it. But if we could just wipe it clean and you could just write one sentence on that whiteboard, what would it be?
Trust. I think, yes, trust is something that has been very important scientifically, personally to me. And it's something that my advisors, both PhD and postdoc advisors, have always given me. Even though with Edith Hurd, for example, the final project that ended up panning out only worked very late. I think it was my fourth project with three complete miserable failure before. And never ever I thought I was going to fail or it was not going to work out. But same with Benoit, we didn't know really where we were going. Initially, we did what we thought was going to be a control experiment where we knew what the result was going to be, and the result turned out to be completely opposite. And I'm building a career on that control experiment. But I think Benoit had this trust that, yeah, if the standard is high enough and you do the thing well, you'll find something interesting. And so there's so much planning that you can do ahead. Things usually don't necessarily pan out the way you planned, and you have to take a leap of faith and be surrounding yourself with people you trust and who can trust you, and establish that, I think, is something very key.
That's great. So as you say, you can't plan everything. If you were to meet the Elfej 15 years younger, what advice would you give him?
Learn math better is one thing. And the other thing, I would say chill out.
Compatible? Learn math and chill out?
Well, I think at some point, if you're very good at math, maybe you can chill out. I don't know if it's fully compatible. But the chill out is don't try to overplan everything, because nothing pans out. But the way you make your plans need to have some wiggle room. If it's too strict, you are setting yourself for being miserable, because there will be reasons, many reasons why the plan will get derailed. And if you don't have the aptitude or the opportunity to adapt and change the plan in a way that is still true to you, you're not going to be super happy. And I think it's also how I try to design scientific projects, or the advice that I give students when they defend their proposals, for example, is you can have a very strong hypothesis, you can have a plan, but if you already decided on what the biology or what the observation must be for it to be interesting, there's a big chance that it's not going to go according to plan, and then you're going to be a little lost. So have directions, but don't be necessarily in something too limiting.
So we're going to wrap up, Elfej, and it has been a delight. So I actually did meet you 15 years ago. and it's been a delight to watch your career develop and watch you grow. So thanks for coming back and sharing some of that with our listeners.
Well, thank you for your mentorship also through all these years.
So where can the heat. So where can people find? I'm not sure I'm going to say it right. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Get in touch by email, or if you want to read a little bit more about the science, we have a very primitive website. I think it's noralab.ucsf.edu.
We'll put it on the show notes.
Thank you. We also have, we are timid Twitterers. We're not putting things very interesting so far, but if you want to get in touch through Twitter, that is also something that we'll read about.
So Elfej, you just reminded me of a Twitter story. I was once in a class. I had asked you to, invited you when you were a PhD student to come and teach a class about epigenetics in this module that I ran. And I tweeted, it was the early days of Twitter, I tweeted, "I'm sitting in a class listening to Elfej Noah speak about epigenetics." And within seconds, I got a tweet from the other side of the world, from San Francisco, from Benoit, who didn't even know me, but tweeted back, convince him to come to my lab. And so I I helped convince you to go to the lab. And
the funny part is, I think you were supposed to send him a letter of recommendation at that time and got overwhelmed and didn't. And I think that was the best letter of recommendation you could ever write me, was a spontaneous phrase.
That's great.
Yeah, that was very funny. And all of that happening with me doing my thing on the board and not understanding even what Twitter was about. But yes, that was very interesting.
Is there one last thing that you want to finish this episode with? No pressure.
I would say yes. Trust, chill, plan ahead, but in a way that is still flexible. And nothing pans out the way you initially planned. It doesn't mean you failed necessarily or that you're not true to yourself. Surround yourself with people who have more experience, people who are better than you. Compartmentalize. Maybe one thing that I would like to end with. This is what I want to end with. It's a piece of advice that Anne Brunet from Stanford gave me when I was starting my lab that really resonates with me. She told me, you need to understand what you're good at. You need to understand what you suck at and be very, very upfront with yourself. Because if you corner yourself, pushing yourself to do the things that you are bad at, you're going to set yourself for failure. So tap in what you are good at. Surround yourself with people who are better than you in the things you cannot achieve. And let's do it. And the point here is not to prove anything to anyone. The point is to get things done. And so you arrange your team around this complementary expertise. Don't recruit people who do what you can already do well. Recruit people who can do the things you can't do.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Elfej. It was great speaking to you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, both of you.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you for joining us at The Lonely Pipit.
We hope that you learned something new, that something resonated with your own experiences, or that you just enjoyed the science.
Let us know your thoughts on Twitter at Lonely Pipit, and please share it with your friends in the lab. If you want to join our community, you can subscribe to The Lonely Pipit mailing list or mail us by following the link available on our Twitter profile. You will receive the next episodes directly in your mailbox. How cool is that?
Stay tuned for the next show, and remember, you might feel like a lonely pipette, but it doesn't mean you're alone. Tips from the Lonely Pipette can help you to do better science.
A bientôt!
A bientôt!
Hey guys, one last thing to finish up. If you like the soundtrack of the show, you might want to know who is the artist behind it. The song is called Lovely Swindler by Amaria, a talented French artist who composes electro swing. We are really grateful for allowing us to use it, and if you like it too, the best thing to do is to share it. Thanks again, and see you soon!